Welcome to Learning Works. I'm Tony Ryan. The concept of strength-based practice is the basis of much of the work done by Dr. Peter Waterhouse in the context of adult literacy and learning. In fact, his address to the 2009 National Conference of the Australian Council for Adult Literacy in Perth last year was entitled "The Strengths in Us All." And it was this theme of strength-based practice that guided my interview with him in Perth last year. Dr. Peter Waterhouse, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tony. It's great to be with you.
Exploring people's stories is always very interesting, I find. Where does your passion come from for literacy and literature?
Oh, wow, that's a big question, isn't it? First of all, I guess it's got pretty deep roots. And books have always been a part of my life. Literacy's always been a part of who I am. I can't really remember not being able to read. I think I learned to read pretty early on and seemingly without a great deal of difficulty. I don't remember trauma about that. I do recall some trauma about learning to write. That's a different story again. And that was considerably later in the process. Yeah, I've always had a bit of a passion about books and literature and story. And I've always had a strong sense that adult literacy education should never lose sight of literature. I get very concerned about adult literacy and numeracy for that matter, which is reduced to mere kind of functionality, for want of a better term. I mean, there's a school of researchers out there that talk about the significance of the cultural domain in literacy, you know, and this notion of three-dimensional literacy, that it's not just about functionality, but it's also about culture and politics and those sorts of things. So, yeah, I've got a sense that literature and the power of literature to move us, the power of literature to connect with us at an emotional level, at an affective level, to touch the heart and the spirit, I think that's a really important dimension of literacy. And I would be distressed if I thought that the adult literacy movement as a sort of a broad collective lost that kind of sensibility. I think it's really important. And in fact, in many ways, I think the functional stuff actually comes from that other stuff. I think the learning to read and write comes from a sense that that literacy has a meaningful place in your life, and then the functional stuff comes after that. So I think that's how it's tied up with issues of identity and personhood and who we are. You know, does literacy mean something to us? Does it make a significant contribution to our lives? For me, it does. And I think for us, it does.
Peter, an important part of your work some years ago was in the project Breathing Life into Training. How has this influenced your thinking about strength-based practice?
Breathing Life into Training project was based within the automotive manufacturing sector. So we were dealing with not tradespeople, but production workers, the people who actually build the vehicles. And we were working quite closely with the Automotive Industry Training Board and with the unions involved at that time. And it was in the context of accredited training being introduced for those production workers. When we became involved with that work, we found that there were some of the major automotive manufacturing companies were already recognising that language literacy and numeracy was an issue. And we had already conducted research in Victoria identifying language literacy and numeracy deficits, if you like, or gaps. At least there were gaps that we perceived could be a difficulty given the way we thought training might go. And some of the companies were already engaging with English in the workplace type programs. But what we found rather disturbing was the fact that in some cases we had, and I'm putting it pretty bluntly here, but effectively we had white Anglo-Saxon middle class female English teachers determining the career pathways of production workers in the automotive industry, because in effect they were saying, you can go on and do the training when your English language is good enough. And so we had a situation where some English language classes had become, in effect, almost like prerequisite sort of conditions or gatekeeping kind of circumstances, that people weren't going to be able to get access to the mainstream vocational training, which was tied to their career path and their salary, their wages, unless they reached a certain standard of English language and literacy determined by what some people would call, you know, standard Australian English, as determined by migrant English teachers, as I say, who were predominantly white Anglo-Saxon female WASPish teachers, you know, with a workforce that was predominantly working class, extremely multicultural, extremely mixed. I think something like close to 70% speaking languages other than English, you know, it's something like 10% of the workforce spoke more than four or more languages. You know, so we had some difficulty with the idea that in some cases, monolingual English teachers were, you know, effectively, or potentially at least anyway, the gatekeepers for determining these people's future. Like at the time, we weren't really using the language strength-based practice. I can't recall anybody using that kind of term. But we certainly did use, and I'm pretty sure in the report itself, we explicitly said that what we were trying to do was to reject the deficit model. So the notion was that, you know, you address literacy by identifying where the deficits are, and then you're trying to build some kind of program to address those deficits. And what we tried to show, I think, with Breathing Life into Training was that there might be a more productive way to engage on these issues. And really, the more productive way, in a sense, it's a more complex way. It's about recognizing that literacy and language issues sit within a social context, or in the case of a workplace, they also sit within an industrial context, which is also simultaneously a political context, a historical context, you know. One of my colleagues said to me, he said, you know, the work we do, he said, we're really kind of industrial anthropologists, which I thought was really a really interesting way of naming it, you know, yes. Because it is about culture. It is about how do people use language and how do people use literacy and numeracy within the context of their lives, you know, whether it, and in the case of Breathing Life Into Training, we were looking at working lives. So it was in that context. And when we started to look at what people were doing and how people were working and what was proposed for the training, we could see that people were going to be disadvantaged unless the systems were tweaked, you know, unless the systems were adjusted. So it was about trying to make the systems work more effectively for the greater good.
Peter, what you're saying raises for me the question of appropriate methodologies in adult education, and what you're talking about probably was reflecting almost a school-oriented approach.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that what was reflected at the time was a sort of a school-based kind of methodology. It wasn't dramatically different in some ways from what I had previously seen in an earlier stage of my career, where we had what were effectively withdrawal classes for students in the secondary school, you know, where kids were identified as being in some way deficient and they were pulled out of the mainstream class, sent to a special class, someone would try and fix them up and then they'd be plugged back in again.
That's an awful word, isn't it? Withdrawal.
Yeah, that's right. And in a way, the model that was evolving at that time was reflecting a similar kind of sentiment. You know, the notion was that there's something intrinsically wrong with these workers. Workers, I might add, that had been producing vehicles since, you know, certainly the older ones were post-World War II migrants, you know, who came out after the Second World War and got jobs in the factories kind of stuff, and had been producing vehicles since that time, and the companies had been producing and, you know, building cars and doing everything that they needed to do. And now seemingly all of a sudden these workers are suddenly deemed to be kind of deficient in some way, and we've got to pull them out and somehow fix them up and then put them back in the system again. Whereas we took the view that we really need to look at the system. We really need to look at how the systems are working and how the training systems are working, and how can we engage with these workers in ways that enable them to demonstrate their capability and enable them to engage rather than to withdraw because of concerns about their own perceptions of inadequate language and literacy and that kind of thing.
But all along, there were strengths within all of them.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, they'd been doing the job for years, you know, and they were very capable people. But as I said, you can set up systems that make people look stupid. When we started to work with the breathing life into training stuff, what we were trying to do was to use action learning principles. I mean, these were people that were much more comfortable in some kind of a learning environment if it involved them in doing something rather than sitting in a classroom and being talked at. So it was a pretty pragmatic kind of approach in some ways. But it was also informed by those principles of action learning and action research, which I suppose in a way, you know, for some of us go back in the literacy movement to people like Paulo Freire, you know, that notion of dialogue, that notion of engaging with people and empowering them in the processes and finding ways to enable them to become co-educators, you know, to become co-teachers, so that in that kind of dialogue, the teacher also becomes a learner. And we were learning from the people on the shop floor as we were working with them.
I'm speaking with Dr. Peter Waterhouse about strength-based practice in literacy and numeracy. I heard you mention Camborne's law. Tell me.
Professor Brian Camborne was certainly one of my mentors at an earlier stage in my career. And in one session that he gave for us, he tongue-in-cheek referred to this notion that he playfully called Camborne's law. And basically what he was saying is that whatever it is that makes the teaching easier for the teacher is probably going to make the learning more difficult for the learner. And the inverse of that as well. And so what this really kind of highlights is the notion that facilitating learning is not necessarily the same thing as teaching, and that when people learn, it's not necessarily because they've been taught. So it's kind of highlighting the idea that if we really want people to learn, we have to explore what will make it easy for them to be able to learn what it is we want them to learn. And it's about trying to build, I suppose, an orientation to learning and facilitating learning, which is more learner-driven rather than teacher-driven. And in order to do that, it often means that you have to go the extra yards to try and facilitate something. So that, I mean, going back to the automotive work, for instance, it meant that we had to do quite a lot of work to facilitate action learning projects for people on the shop floor. That meant that we had to negotiate access for production workers to get access to places like the labs, the laboratories in the factories, or the quality assurance units in the factories. It meant that we had to negotiate for people to get access to other parts of the production process where they wouldn't normally be. Because what we were trying to do was to enable people to learn more about the manufacturing processes, more about the stories, if you like. We wanted them to learn more about the stories of their own work. And oftentimes you find in a workplace that people have only got part of the story. They've only got the part of the story that they're directly involved in. They haven't got the bit before that. They haven't got the bit after that, you know. So in order to enable people to learn more about those sorts of things, we involve people in various sorts of projects, continuous improvement projects, action research projects, where they were exploring issues of concern to them. They were investigating problems or issues that bothered them in the workplace. And oftentimes to do that, to gather the data, to find out the facts, to explore the alternatives, it meant that they had to talk to engineers, they had to talk to production planners, they had to talk to schedulers, they had to talk to accountants and costing people, they had to talk to people in the office, you know, people that they wouldn't normally have contact with. And we were involved in facilitating all of this. You know, so it was kind of hard work for the teachers in order to make the learning easier for the learners.
All of this to me seems to involve motivation and growing self-confidence.
Absolutely, absolutely. It is about motivation. It is about growing self-confidence, and it's about engaging people in using literacy for meaningful purposes that addressed concerns that were important to them. So it wasn't necessarily about the teachers saying, look, this is what's important, this is what we should be reading about, writing about, studying. It was about saying to people on the shop floor, what are you concerned about in this place? What might we be able to do about that? And then in doing something about that is where the language, the literacy, the numeracy skills come in. If you want to gather data on how many production errors we're making or how much rework we're doing in the manufacturing process, it's not a big leap from asking that kind of question to seeing that there's going to be some kind of literacy involved. There's going to be some kind of numeracy involved. You know, you're going to want to count things. You're going to want to record things. You want to tell some kind of story about what's happening. You know, so the language, the literacy, the numeracy becomes an integral part of the issues or the concerns that you're trying to address in that sort of context. And that's what we were doing in breathing in the action research, which was documented in Breathing Life Into Training, and that was published in 1994. But I think the principles have carried all the way through. You know, I think we're still talking about the same kind of principles in the strength-based practice that we might be seeing in community-based adult education settings now, or in TAFE-based settings for that matter too.
Which immediately leads me to ask, what are the implications of all of this for training providers, be they government training providers or RTOs?
I think there's significant challenges in that, Tony, because I think, you know, when the student comes along and is in the process of engaging with an adult literacy program, for instance, or with an adult literacy teacher or educator, one of the things that we found in the research that we were doing on this was that there's a tendency to try to fit the student into the boxes that are available. There's a certain series of programs that are available. There's certain time slots that are available. There's certain funding options that are available. Metaphorically, we might say, you know, we're trying to get the student into our boat, or maybe we've got several different boats and we're trying to fit them into one of them, you know. And maybe a lot of the time that works pretty well. You know, maybe we get a fairly good fit a lot of the time. But the research that we were doing on this really led us to just asking questions about that. You know, does the fit really work as well as we want it to? Are we sometimes shoehorning the learner into our boat because that's the only boat we've got available, when in an ideal world we might be trying to find other ways to get into the student's boat or to get into the learner's boat? I mean, in the contradicting the stereotype research, it was interesting too that one of the individuals in that research talked to us about these sorts of issues, and he said that the most important thing that he experienced really was that after a number of failures, he eventually found a teacher who helped him to understand himself as a learner. And it was about that for him was the most important development. It wasn't actually about literacy per se. It wasn't really about spelling or writing. It was about him beginning to understand his ways of learning, his preferred learning styles, his preferred learning methods, you know, and that's what he found was really useful. And I wonder sometimes whether, you know, whether the boats that we've got available and the boats that we're loading people onto are the right boat, you know, like maybe if it was truly learner-centered, we might be doing more of that kind of work, trying to help individuals find exactly where their strengths and preferences and natural capabilities lie and building on that. And so as literacy teachers or practitioners or as readers or as writers or whatever, our day-to-day, everyday engagements with literacy, I think, really teach what we truly believe about literacy. And I mean that in terms of the interactions that we have with our students and learners, but also with everyone else as well.
But nonetheless, at a very practical level, literacy is pretty necessary to survive in the workplace.
Yeah, it is. It is, and it's becoming more necessary too. I mean, in most places, the bars are being raised. A couple of decades ago, a generation ago, it was easier to leave school and get a job and find yourself in a job where there wouldn't be very much reading and writing involved at all, if any, certainly writing. But nowadays it's increasingly difficult to do that. In existing jobs, the demands are being ramped up. And in other areas, you know, in new areas of work, we see the literacy requirements involving things like the uses of technologies and computers and, you know, all of those sorts of things. And even traditional sorts of areas, whether it might be, you know, pushing a broom on the sweep street or digging graves or, you know, the traditional things that people might have thought of as quote-unquote unskilled kind of jobs. So often now when you look at those sorts of areas of work, you find that they're being performed by people using plant and equipment and technologies and machines and things that they're required to have formal training for. They're required to have a ticket for that now, you know, like, so you don't sweep a street with a broom, you sweep the street with a machine that you've got to have a license to drive, and to get the license you've got to, you know. Mm-hmm. So the reading and writing is coming in more and more, and in most areas the demands are being ramped up higher and higher.
Dr. Peter Waterhouse, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thanks for talking to Learning Works.
Thanks, Tony.
As well as his passionate interest in literacy and numeracy and in strength-based practice, Dr. Peter Waterhouse is also a storyteller, bushwalker, photographer and poet, all of which link into his underlying interests in informal and experiential learning. And that's our program for today. Learning Works is produced with support from the South Australian Government through the ACE and Community Partnerships Unit, Department of Further Education, Employment, Science and Technology. Thanks for being with me today. From PBAFM in Adelaide, I'm Tony Ryan.